and eventually to go down to the moon. If you consider all of those steps, I'm skeptical they're going to make it by 2024, even though the president and the vice president are requesting it. But I'm not sure that they're backing it up with enough money to really make it happen. WS2N with the space report, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TagNet, and Roy, your radio setup works really great, very, very good, great. And as far as 2024, I've been saying that on and off here, that, you know, that's their goal, but I'm sticking with their original time frame at best of 2028. And that's going back, you know, quite a few years ago, even before they planned on the Gateway program. Like you said, it's sort of like an international space station going around the moon, you know, orbit from like 1,000 miles at perigee all the way up to 44,000 miles at apogee. And to set that up is going to be rather difficult. They don't have the SLS rocket ready, space launch system. That was supposed to have flown in 2017, and here we are, 19, and I don't think that's going to get off the ground until maybe late 2021. So they need quite a few of those launches to do it, so since they know they're not going to make that, they're going to depend on private companies like SpaceX or maybe Blue Origin to do it. Let me drop it. WS2N. And financially, they've got problems. You know, NASA gets like, I don't know, they're averaging around $20 billion a year. $4 or $5 billion goes out the window to keep the space station supplied with people and food and material and science equipment. And then they have all these other things that they're involved with, deep space probes, and you know, they've got a you know, national you know, atmosphere. NASA, which is involves aeronautical, you know, National Aeronautics and Space Administration. So it's not only space. They've got money poured into all these different supersonic airplanes they're trying to develop. So they can't take that, you know, parts of those billions of dollars and pour it into the space program. They need, just to start, you know, to get that extra money for the Gateway, $1.6 billion. That's just the start. There's been estimates that they're going to need an extra roughly $30 billion over, you know, over what they're pouring into the program now. So they can't even get the $1.6 billion that they requested. You know, I mean, yeah, you know, they've made crazy deals to try to get money for the wall. They take money from other programs from the military. I guess they could do that, but they'd have to declare a national emergency, trying to get, you know, the first, what they call the first woman to the moon, and then followed by a man. By 2024, it's not a national emergency, so I don't see, you know, between the technology that's needed and the money that's needed, you know, I'm still shooting for 2028, Dick, so I don't know, they've got this guy Bowersock in charge of the, temporarily in charge of the human part of space flight. Bowersock is a retired astronaut. He did some time with SpaceX, but now he's back with NASA. But he's only temporary. They need to get a, you know, a permanent guy in there to really push this along. The last guy they fired, and he was getting older, and he developed, you know, he was one of the guys that developed the shuttle program and all these the beginnings of the space launch system. And they decided to get rid of him without a replacement. So I think there a lot of things have to change and go extremely right. I think think, before they could do with 2024 thing. So I think you're right about that. Back to you.
Now, the one good news is that when we had this mad rush to get man on the moon by the end of the decade of the 1960s, we, in theory, were in this mad rush against Russia as to who's going to get to the moon first and who's going to claim it. They used to think that the high road would be a massively dangerous weapon. In other words, they used to think that something in orbit, all you had to do is let go of it and it'll drop down and bomb something. Not that simple. You let go of it and it stays right with you in orbit. So you have to de-orbit things in a very precise maneuver. So doing bombing from orbit is not good. Doing bombing from the moon to the Earth would not be good. And whoever gets a step on the moon first doesn't mean they can claim the land and keep it. So we had this this phony do-or-die competition, we thought, driving us for the Apollo program. We don't have anywhere near that drive for this particular program. So if the president and vice president said, I want you to do it by 2024, and they do it by 2027, that's not the end of the world. Over to you. And Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, I know. If enough time goes by, I mean, China has long-term plans. You know, their goal is to get people to the moon and set up a base, and so is Russia, and so is even India now. India is going to launch three people into space probably within 2 or 3 years. They're developing that capability. They've already tested a vehicle, sent it into space, and brought it back to test the heat shield. And so, you know, their goal in the beginning, anyway, is to put up their own space station. You know, this is India. So, you know, I mean, at some point in the future, there will be people returning to the moon from different countries. I don't want that. I'd like to see, you know, of course, us do that again before they do it. You know, you're not going to stop them, but, you know, maybe they want to become part of your own, you know, our own base, or there'll be multiple bases. They're all heading to the South Pole. They think that's the sweet spot. So, you know, the reason for that, they can look into certain craters like Shackleton Crater, and because it's completely it never gets any sun inside that crater. You know, they're going to find all this ice and melt it. From that, they're going to get water, and you're going to be able to use that for drinking and washing and electrolysis, and you're going to get hydrogen for fuel cells or oxygen to breathe, or, you know, that's the long-term goal, but, you know, that might be, of course, you know, 20 years out or so more. Any other comments, Dick, before I go on?
Nope, I think we know where we stand with the new man on the moon landing. And so you and I will be watching it, but I don't think we're going to be surprised. And they're already, NASA officials, a few of them, are already giving us warning that it's going to be late. They're going to give it their best shot, their best college try. But they're preparing for us for some delay. Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, I'm glad I got to see it. You know, I know you did, and Roy, and a lot of people listening to us on the net, but there's some younger people that, you know, of course, weren't born when that happened. And they never got a chance to see people landing on the moon and walking on the moon and driving on the moon with the rovers. And there's three rover cars up there that we all got to see. You know, that was very exciting times. Of course, that all went away with Apollo 17. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to see it happen again. Eugene Cernan, the last man on the moon, he really wanted to see people go back to the moon. I mean, that was his lifelong dream after Apollo 17. And now he's no longer with us. So, that's the way it goes. Yeah, I just want to start off with the International Space Station passing overhead is starting to occur on a regular basis with clear nights. I got to see a magnitude 3.3 last night, just after 7 o'clock, 7:11 to 7:17. So it was a 6-minute pass, and it went from the south, southwest, around 42 degrees high and, you know, above the horizon, and over to the east and northeast. And it was very good. I mean, beautiful. And my eyes aren't that good, but I could swear I could see the solar panel sticking out from this thing. I think next time I get a 3.3 magnitude, I'm going out with binoculars. It was pretty cool. There was one right before the net tonight, but I couldn't announce that. And this happens usually dusk and dawn. You know, there's no big lights, you know, on the space station. We're getting the reflection of the sun. We drop it. And, I'll bring the information to you as time goes on. The next one would be actually tomorrow night. But I heard possible showers, so maybe it's going to be cloudy, but partly cloudy. Might be worth a shot. It's a magnitude 2.7. That's still very bright. And that'll be from 7:10 p.m. Again until 7:17, almost the same time frame as last night. And it's going to be higher in the much higher in the off the horizon. Instead of 42, it's going to be around 66 degrees magnitude. And that'll be going from the southwest to the northeast as well. So I'll look for it. Hopefully it's a clear night or partial clear. You know, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, partially cloudy. You can see it go behind the cloud and in and out. You know, no problem doing that. And at a high angle like that, it doesn't even matter if there's trees or anything in your neighborhood or even buildings. I'm sure you can get a good view of it as it goes. It's got six people on board. And that will eventually change next week. Wednesday they have a Expedition 61 launch. Now we'll be going up. They're sending three more people up. You've got a woman, I think she's a doctor, right? Jessica Mearshow. She's from the United States. Oleg Skelepaka is the Russian cosmonaut. He'll be flying it. And on board, they're going to also have first Arab to go to the International Space Station. They've had Arabs fly before, but never going to the space station. And this one's from the United Arab Emirates. So it's first Emirati to go there. And he's not staying long. He's, you know, everybody else is staying for, like, you know, 5-6 months like normal. But he'll be returning in about, you know, 7 or 8 days after getting there. You know, he'll be returning with one of the crew, two people that will be coming back, Nick Haig and Alexei Ovechkin. Nick and Alexei, they were the ones that, about a year or so ago, they shot up to the International Space Station from Kazakhstan, and they didn't make it. You know, they had to abort. The booster crashed into their own core as they were flying up. So Nick and Alexei aborted before they got to orbit, came back down 500 miles or so from where they took off. But they got a second chance, and they got right back into... they jumped in front of everybody else, and they launched them about 6 months ago. and now they'll be coming back. This time they'll be bringing Azhar Ali Alamasodi, I guess it's pronounced, is the and he's a ham radio operative, which he plans on talking to as many people, of course, from his country as he can, you know, via amateur radio. He'll be in a Russian segment. He'll be in the Zarya module. That's where they have their amateur radio set up. We have ours set up in the Columbia module. European Space Agency in the United States, we use the Columbia module, and they use another one. It's in the Zarya module. It's called the Functioning Cargo Block. I don't give it another name. So it's a larger module, and I think they push 25 watts. They have four antennas sticking out of the vertical antennas sticking out of the module, 90 degrees apart from one another. So no matter what the orientation is of the space station, they make it down to the ground. So that's the story on the those launches, the space station. Let me see. Is there any questions or comments before I continue? Okay. There is going to be a launch on the 24th, Tuesday. It'll be Tuesday at 12:05 in the afternoon, so lunchtime. You have the H-2B being launched again to the space station. H-2B is being launched from the Takashima spaceport in Japan. Japan usually launches a cargo vehicle roughly once a year to the space station, and they call them HTVs. And this will be the HTV number 8 for the 8 cargo vehicles to dock with the space station. And their cargo vehicle is actually able to carry more cargo than Russia, easily twice as much, and even more than what we can carry on our cargo vehicles, the Cygnus and the SpaceX Dragon vehicle. You know, they carry almost 13,000 pounds worth of stuff. And they have all kinds of stuff inside the pressurized section, and then on the outside of the HTV, they have all these lithium-ion batteries that they'll be bringing up. There's 6 of them that are going to replace 12 on the space station. I've mentioned this before. It's a process over the years to get rid of the old nickel hydrogen batteries. That's what they call nickel hydrogen batteries. And to replace them with these modern lithium-ion batteries. And, you know, it's a 2-to-1 ratio, so they're getting rid of 12 batteries. And they'll be replacing them with 6. And they've done this 2 previous times before, different parts of the truss sections. The truss sections on the space station is like the length of a football field. And, you know, you have the starboard side, and then you have the port side. All the modules run down the middle, perpendicular to the truss. So going out to, they have different numbers, you know, truss segments, you know, 2, 3, 4, all the way out. They have on truss 4, S4 and S6, they have batteries that are being fed from the solar panels, and the same thing on the port side. And this will be on the port side. They call it a P4 and P6 need replacement. So they'll be doing one setup, and then next year they'll bring up more of these batteries. Each battery weighs like, you know, 300 pounds. These huge batteries. So they take up a lot of weight, and they're quite large. I mean, probably each one is like two suitcases, the size of two suitcases. So it involves multiple spacewalks and usually a lot of work from the robotic arm to take these things, disconnect them from the space station and install the new ones. This is WSON. Any questions?
The batteries they're removing, so they can put into a progress ship and burn up on reentry. Are they thrown away, so to speak? We don't recover those, Paul?
Yeah, because they take up a lot more volume, like I said, it's a 2-to-1 ratio. They can only get rid of, they're disconnecting 12. They can only get rid of 9. So 3 stay behind, permanently attached to the truss section. You know, they have these little work platforms as you go along on a space station. They're going to attach them to that. That's what they've done. So, I mean, in the long, you know, as time goes on, they keep collecting these, you know, three. I guess they'll eventually have 12 of these things that are essentially dead batteries attached to the space station that they don't get rid of. But the other ones, they do use the robotic arm made by Canarom 2, and they take those old batteries and they put them into the HTV number 8, in this case, the cargo vehicle. And as the mission ends for that Japanese module, they do burn it up over the South Pacific there, and that's how they get rid of it.
One of the things that I'm curious about, which is a slightly different subject, Paul, is that the astronauts doing the changing of these batteries and other extravehicular activities outside of the International Space Station, during every one of those seconds of every one of those hours they're out there, during every one of their moves, they have to make double damn sure that they are tethered to something. Because if they forget to connect one of their these clips that mountaineers use, if they forget to connect one of those to a ring that's near
carabiners,
a carabiner-like device, yes. If they forget to connect one of those, and if they do launch themselves into space by mistake, even if only moving away from the object by 1 inch per second, I know they've done some experimenting where the astronauts carry some kind of a portable thrusting device, but I think in general during these EVAs they do not have that on board. If they did make a mistake and started drifting in space, is there a procedure that has been worked out so they could get back to being in contact? Because if you start floating away from the International Space Station in space, and if you have no thrusting device on board, it could be game over. So what do they do to protect themselves from that, Paul? Because with all of those maneuvers, just one, you know, just forget to connect yourself for a couple of seconds and you can get yourself into a lot of trouble. WS2N, K2RAW.
Yeah, it's fun to watch the EVAs. If you have NASA or you know, you can get it on your computer now. And there's gold handles all over, you know, gold-looking handles all over the space station. And you see them constantly doing just what you said, you know, disconnecting and then reconnecting. And they, you know, there's always two connections. So, you know, you disconnect one, you're still attached to the other one. And some of them have these retractable things on it where you can connect and you walk away from it and it goes out like 20 feet or so. But yeah, you're always connected. If for some reason somebody makes a mistake, But they're really good at this. They're in constant communication with NASA. You hear them say, you know, connect to handle number, you know, 228 or something, you know. If they made a mistake, they would start floating away. And on their backpack, that whole backpack setup they essentially wear two backpacks. They have one for their consumables, their radios, there's water supply, air conditioning, heating setup. You know, but then there's a thinner one that you know blends in with that. So it all looks like one backpack, but it's that the one that's really on the very back of them, and it extends pretty far down to their waist, is what they call the safer backpack, and that's an acronym, and I forgot what the acronym is, but that means it's loaded with pressurized nitrogen, and they can fly themselves back to the space station if that's what happens. Every EVA has that. Back to you.
Interesting. So they do have a thrusting device on board as a backup, and using the double tethering is the right idea. Connect the new tether before you disconnect the old one. When I climb my tower, I do the same thing. I carry two safety harnesses, and I connect it as I climb the tower. I connect the click and lanyard, the carabiner and lanyard, on the next step up before disconnecting the previous one. So I'm connected at all times. So if I slipped and fell on the tower, I would just fall to the end of the tether. Okay, glad they do that, because that would be horrible to go drifting in space, because other than that, the only thing you could do is try to fly the International Space Station toward the astronaut. And that's out of the question. You're taking thousands of tons of equipment to try to recover a 200-pound man. Back to you, Paul. Glad they've got that safer. And I guess they've always used it, K2RIW.
Oh, yeah. I'm just imagining. Yeah, no, you can't move the space station that easy. A million pounds worth of stuff. And then let's say you want to rotate the space station. You know, they don't necessarily use thrusters. You know, they have these momentum wheels, essentially big gyros, and there's four of them. There might be six, like a couple of backups, and then they're located in the Z1 structure. Z1 structure is right above the Unity node. Unity node was one of the first pieces that went up there back in 2000, and they attached the Z1 structure to it. Z1 inside, Z1, well, you know, the outside looks like trusses, but there is one little section of that that you can go in there and actually breathe. You know, it's got like a dome to it, and but that section has these spinning momentum wheels and there's gyros involved, and that's what keeps the space station steady, and they can actually rotate it if they have to. So, I mean, these things are spinning like thousands of RPMs a second, or a minute, you know? And it's actually attached to the Unity node. That's where a lot of the astronauts sleep. They sleep on a wall. They have their little compartments. And I often think, you know, I wouldn't want that compartment with the one with the spinning gyros right above my head, you know? They say they don't hear it, you know? It must be a funny feeling. There's a lot of mass in those things. Let me drop it.
When it comes to rotating the International Space Station, it has to do one complete 360-degree rotation every 90 minutes, because it's going around the Earth, and I think they attempt to keep one face of the International Space Station always pointed toward the Earth, and you get these gimbals on the solar panel, which have to track the sun. So there's a lot of pivoting and rotating going on, as I see it, every 90 minutes. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
You get the solar panels and the radiators. They all, you know, they're connected to, they call them alpha joints and beta joints. So the alpha joints are the big joints, the biggest thick as a car, like a big Volkswagen, you know, that size. And it, those, that rotates all the, you know, the end truss pieces with, you know, on the starboard side you have a setup like that, and on the port side you have a setup like that. And it rotates those big 240-foot long solar panels, SAWs they call them, SAW, solar array wings. And it's not a misnomer that they use the word wing. They actually use them as a wing for certain purposes. But these solar array panels are rotated and constantly moving to face the sun. And not only that in that direction, but then they have the beta joints at the bottom of each solar panel before it connects to the main truss section. There's another rotational motor that spins them individually. So, you know, you can spin them to, you know, more accurately toward the sun. So it's a complicated setup. When they came up with this boy, they were really, they must have been really out there thinking how they were going to do all this. And it's been being done since, what, 2000? Let me drop it.
Yeah, the total dimensions are, I think, beyond the dimensions of a football field, maybe even including the stadium. And I think you said it's close to 1 million pounds of hardware. Are they still bringing up modules? They're bringing up batteries and consumables. Are they still bringing up modules? Is the total mass of the International Space Station continuing to slowly increase? In which case, do they intend to be using it to the year 2024, 2027? I mean, you've made a big investment to bring all this hardware up there, both cost and pounds of thrust and whatever. Once you got it up there, you don't want to give it up, as I see it. Over to you, Paul, K2RW.
Oh, yeah. It's 1 million pounds, and it's not really growing that much anymore. Russians plan on sending up another module in the future. We plan on sending up another docking setup called the Bishop. That, you know, that's not that big, but that would add something to the mass. But the Russian module is pretty big. That's called the Nakia, N-A-U-K-A module. That's been under development for over a decade. And because of Russia's problems, they haven't gotten up there on the space station yet. But they plan on sending that up. And to do that, they have to get rid of one of the small docking modules called the Piers docking module, which is on the Zenith port. They're going to eventually connect that to a Progress rocket and deorbit that over the Pacific, burn it up. And then this new Nokia module, which is going to have another bathroom, and it's going to have a laboratory, and I mean, it's a big module that they never, they were, you know, it was planned 20 years ago, and it's still not attached. I don't know if it's ever going to be attached, but it's still planned for it. Let me drop it. As far as flying in one, you know, in one plane, yeah, they're always, they have to, the space station is actually making one orbit, just like the Earth is making one orbit every 90 minutes. But, you know, it really doesn't take any fuel for that. You know, it's just set up that way, you know, as you're rotating it, you know, once it's set like that, it just faces the Earth. You know, it itself is actually spinning on its axis, if you think about it. And the whole setup, if you imagine like an airplane and picture these truss sections I was talking about, which is over 300 feet long, as like the wings. You know, you have a right wing and a left wing. Picture it that way, and down the middle you have a fuselage. Down the fuselage, instead of a plane fuselage, you have a series of these modules, you know, main connecting modules, you know, one after the other. You know, in the front you have all the American modules and the European Space Agency modules. As you work back toward the, let's call it the tail, you're getting into the Russian modules. Let me drop it. That's the best way to think of it. And then there's a zenith and a nadir. Well, the one looking down, they want to keep one always looking down. And the reason for that is that's where everybody goes into look out the windows. There's these trapezoidal-looking windows, and in the middle is a round window. So you can put two people in there at a time. You know, you float into the tranquility module, another big module. You know, it's probably 28 feet long, 14 feet in diameter. And on one of the ports, one of these ports, they have the cupola attached. The cupola is this setup that they set up many years ago, which contains all these windows, these trapezoidal windows, with one big round one in the middle. And when you go in there and you look at that, you're looking at the Earth. So that's always looking at the Earth. So I think that's the best way to think of it, you know. And then these main modules going down, then they have modules coming off, you know, off the port side, and they have modules coming off the starboard side, and then you have other available modules for docking, and they're usually on the bottom. And then a couple of them are on the top. Roughly, that's a good idea of how to think of it. The ones on the bottom, let me drop it. For what actually I call berthing, is for cargo modules that go up. So you take this HTV-8 that's going to go up, and that's going to attach itself. That'll be attached to the bottom of the space station. It'll stay there for a month or so, and then they'll deorbit that. You got the Dragon that comes up. That could also attach to any one of those bottom modules. When I say any one, there's two. It's called the Unity, and then the one on the very end is Harmony. So you could, you know, you put the two cargo modules on the bottom, on the top, the very top of those same two modules, the Harmony on the very end, the nose of it, and then the Unity. That's where you could come along and dock people to it, you know, if you wanted to. They set it up where they don't need the Unity one for that. They use the Harmony one on the very end, and you're gonna have docking coming in on the top, and you're gonna have docking coming in on the starboard side for people. And let me drive it. Surprising in time and out. And those docking modules for people will be the Boeing Starliner that's going to eventually carry four people up, and you're going to have the Crew Dragon, which also will be able to carry four people up. And that's the layout. The Russians are a little different. Russians don't have the, you know, the setup for cargo and the setup for people. They don't have berthing or docking. You know, it's either or for us. And but as far as they're concerned, in the back, you know, all their cargo vehicles, progress vehicles, they call them, or Soyuz crew vehicles, are the same. They all connect to, you know, they're all docking, all autonomous. But then their crew is 1 meter in diameter, and then they can come in. And that's the same for the cargo. With us, you know, the cargo, you've got, you know, 50-inch doors, you know, big square doors that open up, and you can bring up big racks of supplies, big spacesuits, no problem. But the Russians have difficulty. So there's pros and cons. They could dock quicker, separate quicker on all their vehicles, cargo and the manned vehicles. With us, on our side, we could dock quick and separate quick with people. That'll be all autonomous. But the berthing process, we use the robotic arm from Canada that's attached to the space station. Grab the vehicle as it approaches. You'll see that next week with the HTV 8 on the 28th. It'll be the docking. And then they use that arm and permanently attach it to the space station. Back to you, Dick. Any other questions from anybody else? This is WS2M.
The International Space Station, the air pressure inside, is it 14.7 pounds per square inch like we got on the surface of the Earth? Or is it a higher oxygen content like they do in the spacesuit, and maybe it runs at 5 pounds? How many pounds per square inch is the air pressure in the space station, though, Paul?
Yeah, it's atmospheric. One bar, 14.7 pounds. Nitrogen and oxygen, same proportion that we have here on Earth. They're missing the, you know, argon and, you know, whatever minor elements that we have here on Earth. But, you know, it's the same, what is it, 21% or something oxygen and 70-some-odd percent nitrogen. So that's what they're doing on the space station.
Okay. One square foot of material with 14.7 pounds per square inch of air on one side and vacuum on the other side experiences a total amount of force of 2,100 pounds. One ton of force per square foot. I think you said some of those openings are 50 inches square, 50 inches wide, 50 inches high. If that's so, that's 17 square feet is that opening. 17 times 2 is 35,000 pounds of force. It's just the air pressure trying to separate the two objects that are docking. Can you imagine the amount of force on all of those boats, bolts? 35,000 pounds of force. If you've got a module with a 50-inch door, mated with a 50-inch door on the International Space Station, and both of it 14.7 pounds per square inch, that air pressure is trying to separate you, trying to blow you apart by 35,000 pounds. Wow. Over to you, Paul, KGRIW.
Yeah, total force, but, you know, if you divide that up to the 16 bolts that are holding it together. Now, I said square door. It looks like a square door. It looks like a garage door when it opens. They grab it, and it has that kind of look. If you look at it, it's on two tracks. They're on wheels. You know, picture a square door, a wheel on each corner. But two of the wheels are on one set of tracks, the other two wheels on the other set of tracks. So after the pressure is equalized in the vestibule, the area between the docking spacecraft and the inside module, in the, you know, once that you know, they open a valve and it becomes equal pressure between the two, then they're able to open up this door, and you see them, and the door actually pulls in, the whole thing pulls in to the inside of the space station a little bit, and then it's able to rise up. And if you look at the tracks, you can figure out how they do it. It's a good design. This way, when it seals, you know, it doesn't come down and, like, scrape along, you know, and then seal it. When it comes down flush, and it's actually facing, you know, all four sides are perfectly even, and then, you know, as they roll it in, because, you know, the track curve at a 90-degree angle at the last second, it's able to close. So they have a tight seal there. But that's the square door. Now, the picture circle around the square, I mean, it's actually bigger than the 50-inch door. And that's the actual part that bolts. If you would actually stand inside the vestibule, you want to fit, but, you would be inside, and you'd see this whole round connection all the way around you. That one has 16 bolts. Each bolt is 5/8-inch thick diameter. So they're big bolts. And each bolt, I think, torques up to 16 PSI, 16,000 pounds pressure. you know, torque on every single bolt. That's an amazing amount of torque on these things. So that's why it takes time to dock and time to, well, not dock, berth and then unberth. That's why you can't have that set up for crews that come up. Crews have to be able to come up, soft dock, and connect real quick, and then they can open the door and come into the space station. And the reason for it is if there's an emergency on the space station, you have to get out real quick, so, you know, and disconnect real fast. So they go into the spacecraft, and they're able to separate in, you know, in a matter of minutes, you know, maybe 5-10 minutes, they could actually undock from the space station and get away if they have to. You wouldn't be able to do that. It's too time-consuming with this whole bulb-up procedure. Dick, back to you.
That's amazing. Okay, so the 50-inch square opening, if that was the only thing that is present between the two docked objects, there'd be 36,000 pounds of total force because of 14.7 pounds per square inch. 36,000 pounds, 16 bolts, 2,270 pounds per bolt just due to air pressure. And then you've got to have some extra tightening of the bolt to compress the, there's probably a rubber gasket in there somewhere to make sure it's not leaking. And because the bolts are in this circular pattern, which is even a bigger area than the 50 square inches, 50 inches wide, 50 inches high of the actual opening, my 36,000 pounds is a low number. It's probably closer to 45,000 total. So each of those bolts, I think you said they're tightened to what, something like 6,000 pounds? So something like 2,500 pounds per bolt just due to air pressure. And then the additional tension on the bolt to make sure you're compressing the rubber seal. Is there a rubber seal there, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, I've seen it. It's like a big flange you would have. You know, it protrudes a bit. And then I guess it's whatever it's made of, it's probably, you know, neoprene or something. You know, some kind of space age, it's not, you know, a big rubber gasket. So yeah, that's permanently attached. There's two of them. Everything's double. So yeah, I remember going through this a long time ago, and that it was fascinating. I think it was 16,000 foot pounds of torque on each 5/8 diameter bolt. A 5/8 diameter bolt is pretty heavy duty. You look at 5/8, and that's all done electronically. It enters the holes and it spins up. I don't think, I forget which end spins, but you know, this motor is turning on each one of these bolts. They try to tighten up, you know, four, and then they tighten up the other four, so on and so forth. You know, it's not like they drive, you know, 1, 2, and then all the way around 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. They don't do that. That would be bad. You know, it's, you know, opposite. You know, it's like a wheel on a car. You know, you don't go all the way around. It's two and then two and then two. You know, it's that type of setup thing. You know, back to you.
So 5/8 diameter bolt and something like 16,000 foot pounds, if I understand you correctly, of torque is applied to that bolt. Wow. I'm beginning to think, and these are all driven by motors. So you've got 16 motors, I presume, driving 16 bolts, and you've got to make sure that every one of those motors works. If one or two of those bolts side by side don't get tightened properly, you could develop one hell of a leak. And there was a leak on the one of the Russian spacecraft. A small, I think they said it was a two millimeter hole that had to be cured with epoxy, that they were leaking air. And for a while, the Russians didn't want to admit that leak existed. But all those 16 motors, 16 individual motors, tightening 16 bolts to 16,000 foot-pounds, I presume these are gear motors. There's got to be some kind of a check mechanism to make sure that each bolt got properly tightened And if not, there must be some kind of a manual backup procedure if the motor didn't do the job. Over you, Paul, K2RAW, at a sound system.
Yeah, I read they look at the amperage. I haven't seen the motor. I've seen what it's encased in. But I tried to look, PDF files and everything else. I couldn't find the exact, what the motor, really looked like, I get close, but I don't know. Maybe they keep that a secret. I don't know, Dick.
Just starting those bolts is an interesting procedure. When you're bringing those two surfaces together with a 50-inch aperture, 50 by 50 aperture, there must be the equivalent of pig stippers, spikes on one side and holes on the other side, tapered spikes, that forced proper alignment so that when you take these captured bolts, and I hope they're captured bolts, powered by a motor, that they line up with the holes correctly so you're not cross-threading those bolts when you're starting to start tightening the bolts from one side to the other. And by the way, are the bolts on is the head of the bolt on the inside of the space station, or is the head of the bolt on the inside of the module that's coming up to the space station? Over to you, Paul, K2RAW.
Yeah, it looks like it's on the space station. And the nuts themselves, they don't rotate. I think the studs themselves are attached to some gearing mechanism. I think it's the studs that spin. I can't find the exact system on what they do, but something along those lines. If I ever see it, I'll bring it up again, put a net. Dick, I just want to, I'm running out of time. I just want to bring up this one topic anyway that I thought Dr. Roy would be interested in. Let me cover this first.
Go right ahead, Paul.
Yeah, this has to do with this. There's a team of scientists, and they call them healthcare workers in Ireland that developed this drone. And it's not a helicopter type drone. It's a fixed wing type of drone, and it looks like it's about six feet in diameter, 6 feet across. And the idea is to bring drugs to, in this case, an island off the coast of Ireland itself, to this remote island, to somebody that's living there that needs these drugs. And it was two purposes. They wanted to bring this medicine, whatever it was. I have it written down somewhere. Where the heck is this? I'll find it somewhere. But they want to bring the medicine to these people, and they needed to bring the blood back. So here it is, carrying insulin and glucagon. GLUCAGON prescription medicines, and also to collect blood samples and bring them back. And the idea of this test or system that they had was to fly this drone. It had to fly around 500 feet in the air. It went 120 miles an hour, and they needed to be successful. They wanted to make it an over the horizon thing, so you couldn't see it. So it went like 15 miles or something from wherever they launched it from. And after that, they managed to bring it back. My question to Roy would have been, don't they need to refrigerate this stuff or something? This must be some high-tech drone. Or maybe blood samples don't have to be refrigerated. I thought, if you take blood out of somebody, you can't just put it on any old drone and fly it. I would imagine it would have to be refrigerated. They do on the space station when the samples come back, things are frozen. And I don't know what. But they have a picture of the drone and the people standing there. I should have sent it to Roy, but I didn't do it yet. Back to you, Dirk.
I'm guessing it's packaged in dry ice in a very well-insulated foam box or something like that, Paul. And I think I've seen drones being proposed to transfer organs, livers and kidneys and things like that, as well as blood and medicine. These drones are doing good work. Back to you, Paul. You're getting short on time.
Okay, very good. Yeah, it's the National University of Ireland, Galway, G-A-L-W-A-Y, the team. Pretty good. I mean, you know, the idea is to make this a regular thing in case there's disasters or whatever. And, you know, they have to be able to get something somewhere where the airport is washed out, like happened recently with that last hurricane in the Bahamas. So, yeah. All right, I'm not going to go on. We'll talk about future things next week. And we'll be here. I know where I won't be here, but we'll see. We'll be back next week, and then we'll see Roy, I guess, 2 weeks from now. Back to you, Dick, K2RIWWS.
Now, you and I ought to tell everybody we know, make up a whole lot of questions, so we'll make the question and answer period longer to try to take up some of the time that would have been Roy's. We're going to miss you, Roy. Back to you, Roy. Bye-bye for the next 2 weeks, 73, and thank you. EC2GS, for any final comments. Bye-bye for now, K2RIW. You got it, Roy.
Thank you very much, Dick, and as the saying goes, leave them wanting more, so I guess I succeeded. I'm going to miss you guys as well, but hopefully I'll have twice as many puzzles. You never know. As always, I like to remind people that any inquiries, mailbag questions, topics, questions, reputations, the email address is mailbag@alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. That's mailbag@ac2gs.com. And all the articles that I mentioned are available on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com. And once again, I'd like to thank Dick, I'd like to thank Paul, and I'd like to thank everyone who participated tonight in my little science talk. I appreciate it. And for the people observing, I wish them a good Rosh Hashanah. And I'll see all you guys, I'll speak with all you guys in 2 weeks. This is AC2GS, and I'll be clear.
Very good. Okay, 73. And Limehawk is the best of the info net on Monday night at 8:30, so tomorrow. 73.
Bye-bye, you all.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. At 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
JA2SYJ, Central Japan, Tokyo. This was a big matter. Juliet Alpha 2, Sierra Yankee Juliet.
W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL.